Welcome to Common Good, the Values and Capitalism podcast brought to you by the American Enterprise Institute. This is Tyler Castle recording in downtown Washington, D.C. in the 11th floor studio at AEI. My guests this episode are Congressman Frank Wolf and Elise Anderson. Mr. Wolf represented the 10th District of Virginia in the U.S. House of Representatives for over 30 years and is now Jerry and Susie Wilson Chair in Religious Freedom at Baylor University and Distinguished Senior Fellow for the 21st Century Wilberforce Initiative. Elise Anderson was a senior foreign policy advisor to Mr. Wolf on Capitol Hill and is now senior advisor and director of special projects at the 21st Century Wilberforce Initiative. In our conversation, we discuss the plight of religious minorities in Iraq and the rest of the Middle East, and my guests offer suggestions for what the U.S. government, the church, and the American people can do to bring about change. We'll take a short break and be back with Frank Wolf and Elise Anderson. Stay with us. Back with our guests, Congressman Frank Wolf and Elise Anderson. Mr. Wolf represented the 10th District of Virginia in the U.S. House of Representatives for over 30 years, becoming known as a passionate advocate for human rights and religious freedom. Today, he carries out those passions in his roles as Jerry and Susie Wilson Chair in Religious Freedom at Baylor University and Distinguished Senior Fellow for the 21st Century Wilberforce Initiative. Elise Anderson spent a number of years on the Hill as a foreign policy advisor to Mr. Wolf. She has also worked with the U.S. Department of State and the Center for Religious Freedom at Freedom House. She is now senior advisor and director of special projects at the 21st Century Wilberforce Initiative. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be
here. Thanks for the invitation.
Of course. So a lot of people care about these issues of religious freedom, religious persecution. Why have both of you dedicated so much of your time to this issue?
Well, I first developed a passion working on these issues as an intern in Congressman Wolf's office back in college. It was the summer before my junior and senior year, and it was at the height of debate surrounding most favored nation trading status for China, and I saw a really compelling coalition of groups and individuals come together in opposition to that legislative initiative. Unfortunately, ultimately, we were unsuccessful, but it kind of awakened me to what was going on around the world, human rights abuses and specifically religious freedom abuses, both for Christians, but not exclusively for Christians, people of faith in China. And of course, you open the paper today, you see the Islamic State on the march throughout the Middle East. And so I really view this as the human rights issue of our day and something that as a Christian that I'm deeply concerned about.
And this is proof that as an intern in Congress, you actually get to do substantive work. So that's encouraging to hear.
Absolutely.
During this time, we're seeing more persecution than perhaps any other time in modern times. In China, Catholic bishops under house arrest, Protestant pastors, Buddhist monks, about 120 have poured kerosene on their body and set themselves aflame. And so, but in the Middle East, more biblical activity took place in Iraq than any other country of the world other than Israel. Abraham, Ezekiel's buried there. Daniel lived there. Daniel's buried there. Rebecca from the Bible. The 12 tribes of Israel lived there. And yet we are now seeing Christianity coming to the extinction. And every person we met, every person said, does anyone in the West care? And I just think it's amazing. I think there's been such a shift in this country. 30 years ago, during the Reagan administration, young people were deeply concerned. If you're going to follow the teachers of the Bible, Jesus talks about this over and over. It's mentioned in Luke over and over, and yet we just see the church in the West just almost asleep. There have been some exceptions. Pope Francis has spoken out. Cardinal Worrell has spoken out. Cardinal Dolan has spoken out. Russell Moore has spoken out. Rick Warren. But overall, there's total silence. So during the time that many of the people who are watching you are going to be graduating, going on, we will see the end, the extinction of Christianity. I think there's going to be a tremendous feeling of guilt by people of faith who have literally watched and then ISIS, what they're doing to them. And these people have been asked to convert. They've refused to convert. They stand up for the faith, but yet they say, does anyone in the West care? And, you know, I have to tell them, you know, at a time, unfortunately, not many care. Not many care. Or if they do care, it's kind of, I'll read a story in a newspaper, but I'm not going to do anything about it. And frankly, if you go read Martin Luther King's speech from Birmingham Jail, he expressed great disappointment in the church. The church did not stand with him. And he talks about, you know, the silence of the church. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who everyone says they admire, says not to speak is to speak, not to act is to act. So the church in the West, by not speaking, is really saying, we don't really care. We're going to go on. We're going to do our own things. We're going to have spring break. We're going to make sure we have a great place for vacation. We don't really, oh, yeah, we'll read the article, but we really don't care. So during this generation, this time, we will see the extinction of Christianity in the cradle of Christianity. Abraham was from Ur, which is modern-day Nasiriyah. We will see literally the end. There will always be a remnant. There'll always be a few handful, but we will see the little of the end. And ISIS, they're just destroying the ancient sites. They blew up Jonah's tomb 4 months ago, and the response from the West has been, oh, well, so, you know.
Yeah, so just a few months ago, both of you were in Iraq. What you spoke about it a little bit there, but were there a few things that surprised you in conversations that you had, things that you saw, anything? Is there anything different or even more extreme than you expected?
I don't know that I would say more extreme, but I think the narrative that often we're confronted with in the West is the most kind of grievous examples of human rights and religious freedom abuses. So you hear stories of beheadings or crucifixions, but what you don't hear are the stories of thousands and thousands of people who, in a matter of hours, were pushed out of their homes, fleeing ISIS, and are now living as essentially nomads in their own countries. We met with upwards of 70 different people, Christians and Yazidis, who last summer, as ISIS was moving through Iraq and seized Mosul and ultimately the Nineveh Plains, they essentially left with nothing more than the clothes on their backs. And these were professional men and women. You know, it's more akin, to use a kind of local comparison, to Vienna, Virginia being evacuated overnight, as opposed to, you know, a tribal place somewhere. So, you know, they had bank accounts, they had homes, they had cars, and here they are living in containers and unfinished shopping malls and, you know, sports complexes, relegated to refugee status within their own country. And so there was really just a sense of, in some respects, hopelessness about their kind of prospects within Iraq. I mean, we were told that 12 Christian families are leaving each day. At the same time, there's a really vibrant faith. You know, to a person, when asked, given the suffering that you've encountered, do you find yourself questioning God's goodness, or, you know, find your faith wavering? And you could hardly even get the question out before people were kind of quick to say, no, why would you even think that? So in some respects, I think we in the West who are Christians have a lot to learn from our brothers and sisters in places like Iraq, who are undergoing tremendous suffering and pain and yet have a really vibrant and robust and bold faith. You know, I don't know what I would do in the face of that type of suffering and having to be confronted with abandoning my faith if it meant my children would survive. They've made very difficult choices. And so in some ways, yes, we can be their advocates, but they can, I think, strengthen our faith here in the United States, in the West.
And they have refused to convert. We talked to one man whose wife had cancer, breast cancer. ISIS took over their village. They went to Mosul for treatment. They said, we will treat you if you convert. The wife refused to convert and died. The husband refused to convert. And yet here we are in Holy Week. I mean, we just had, you know, Palm Sunday. Now we're coming up to Good Friday. And Peter denied Christ 3 different times. 3 different times. Mm-hmm. Peter, who saw Christ, who saw him. These people never saw Jesus, and they're not converting. Not denying him. And yet we in the West, we stand by, and we just – it's an interesting story. This administration is not helping the Peshmerga who's defending. They're not putting aid over there. And so I'll tell you, I just think 5 years from now, when Christianity is extinct in that region, the burden of guilt that the West will have will be unbelievable. It'll be – and so – but they don't convert. They remain true. So – if we want to save Christianity in that region, we better do something here in the West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the report that you wrote, it was a striking number that about 10 years ago there were 1.5 million Christians in Iraq, and now there's about 300,000. That's a huge a drop in number. What do you think it's going to take to stop that, to protect these lands and let these people stay in their homes?
I mean, ultimately, the defeat and destruction of the Islamic State, I mean, that's the first kind of order of business. But as you note, long before the Islamic State, these communities were being besieged and Christians and other religious minorities were leaving in droves. Yes, there's a conversation taking place within the Congress right now with respect to the authorization of use of military force against ISIS. And until ISIS is defeated, there will be no hope for these communities to survive. ISIS has no toleration for the other, whether that's Christians, Yazidis, other forms of Islam. So that needs to be part of the conversation. But I think we are wrong to assume that simply by pushing back ISIS that the Christians will be quick to reclaim the lands where they've historically lived. You know, there's been a tremendous fraying of trust. They feel betrayed. We read stories even in Tikrit right now of ISIS booby trapping cities and villages, planting IEDs. I mean, what will they have to return back to? So this is going to be a long process. They are currently standing up what's called the Nineveh Protective Unit. It's essentially a National Guard defensive unit, because for too long they've had to depend on others for their protection, and frankly, they've been failed. So regardless of what happens within the congressional debate surrounding the use of military force, already the administration has the authority to give assistance to these Nineveh protective units, and they haven't done so to date. So that's an easy first step.
When ISIS beheaded the 21 Coptic Christians in Libya, the New York Times said 21 Coptic Christians beheaded. The Guardian in England said 21 Coptic Christians beheaded. The administration, the Obama administration, said 21 Egyptian citizens beheaded. Mm. So if you're not willing to call it what it is. Yeah. Secondly, ISIS, they're coming here. They're already connected to Al-Shabaab in Somalia, who just killed a lot of people this weekend. They're connected to Boko Haram in Nigeria. They're now active in Afghanistan. They were the ones who did the beheading in Libya. They've been active now in Europe. There have been over 150 Americans who have gone to fight with them. There are 5,000 to 6,000 to 7,000 Europeans who are fighting with ISIS, who all have one or the visa waiver program. They can come here. So ultimately, you have to defeat ISIS. But before you do that, you have to recognize what we're up against. And if the administration won't say the word Christian, if they won't say that word Christian, if they just say citizens, then frankly, for the next 2 years, it's almost hopeless. And if the American people do not rise up and get this Congress to act and get this administration to act, we literally will see the end of Christianity. You know, there is a saying out in the region, first the Saudi people and then the Sunni people. The Saudi people, the Jewish community. The Jewish population of Iraq in 1950 was about 150,000. Today, there are roughly four individuals.
Wow.
Four left. What is taking place to the Jewish community is going to take place to the Christian community. And if you recall, the West stood by and allowed the Holocaust to take place. Even in America, nobody wanted to kind of say it. And now you're seeing anti-Semitism in Europe, but you're seeing anti-Semitism on the American campuses. This administration says nothing. And so until there's a recognition and an understanding, it's hard to do what you have to do.
So like you just said, faith really is central to this and religious freedom. So what difference does that make in our strategy? How should we go about it differently, knowing that it's not just violent extremists, it's people targeting people because of their faith?
Nina Shea, who some of your listeners may be familiar with, she directs the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, and she's written about this specifically with respect to what's happening in Syria, that if you understand the mindset of the Islamic State, that you could better, and it was touched upon also in a pretty prominent Atlantic Monthly piece, that you can understand where they're going to go next. And you look at certain regions in Syria, the Khabur Valley, where the Christians historically have lived, you can guess that that's where they're going to head next. Well, if we're unwilling, if our administration is unwilling to understand or to recognize the theology and the ideology that animates the Islamic State, then we're going to put ourselves at a disadvantage, both militarily, diplomatically, across the board. So, that's the first order of business. But frankly, it's been a shortcoming for years now. I remember having interactions with the State Department 6-7 years ago where already we were seeing Christians and other religious minorities targeted in Iraq, and they refused to recognize that they were anything more than part of the generalized violence that was taking place in Iraq. Well, they've been disproportionately affected since 2003 by the sectarian violence, and our State Department is always unwilling to recognize that the religious freedom has not been a priority. The post of Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom has been vacant for more of this administration than it's been filled. So it's to the detriment of our own national security, because increasingly we're seeing religious freedom intersect with national security, but it's obviously also to the detriment of people of faith around the world who are suffering these abuses.
Paul could not go on the road to Damascus to Straight Street. The road is too dangerous. Abraham couldn't leave Ur and go to where he went. I mean, and so it's radical Islamic fundamentalism. That's what it is. And as Elise just mentioned, every one of your listeners should go Google Atlantic Monthly, March 2015, by a guy named, I think it's Graham Woods.
Yeah.
You got to read it. That's just who it really is and who what's happening. And if we don't deal with this thing now, we passed a bill, the Congress passed a bill in the last session to set up a special envoy to advocate for Christians and other religious minorities in the Middle East, the Ahmadis in Pakistan, the Baha'is in Iran. It passed the House, passed the Senate, signed by the President. The President has not appointed anyone to fill the role. This administration doesn't care. At times, I don't know if the Congress even cares. I'm not even sure the American people care. I don't know that anybody cares. And so what we're seeing is this thing is moving and rolling, and it is coming here. And so I think we all have a moral obligation to do what Martin Luther King says, to speak out. We have a moral obligation to do what Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, not only to speak but to act. And we fail to do that, we will literally see on our watch the end of Christianity, but also the Baha'is are suffering tremendously in Iran. Pastor Abedini's in prison in Iran, in a brutal prison. The Ahmadi Muslims are being killed in Pakistan, and the West says nothing about it. The West is facing, if we don't deal with this, the way that we have done in the past. President Reagan said the words in the Constitution, the words in the Declaration of Independence were a covenant with the people of the world, not only with the people in Philadelphia in 1776 and 1787, with the entire world. That covenant is being ripped up and destroyed by this administration. And frankly, unless the American people wake up, we will see during our lifetime the end of Christianity and many other religions in that region.
Just to add to that, I'm not a millennial. I aged out by a couple of years, but I know a lot of your listeners are. And historically, and I've seen this in the millennials that I've interacted with, I think there's a strong justice orientation among this generation. And you look back over time, whether it was in the 80s and American Jewish youth who are at the forefront of advocating for the Jewish refuseniks and others living behind the Iron Curtain, the movement there for Soviet Jewry. You had campuses in the 80s, aflame with righteous indignation at apartheid. I think there's great potential for American youth, specifically American Christian youth on campuses today, to really be the kind of animating force to awaken the conscience of the church in the West about what's happening in the Middle East. And whether it's social media is something that those previous movements didn't have at their disposal. But, there's a lot that could be done now, and really American Christian college students could be at the forefront.
The thing that I think about this issue is so many people care about it and think, like they see these tragedies happening, but yet it feels so distant, almost surreal. Like, it's hard to imagine that this is actually happening. The two of you were there 2 months ago, so you saw it. But for those of us who are, here in America, for college students, for the U.S. church, are there any concrete ways that you can suggest that we get involved with this mission?
Sure. I think when you read the Bible, Luke 4, so many other passages, Jesus talks about this. So if we really want to forget the different breakdowns or arguments between denominations, we really want to follow Jesus, then I think we're obligated to really be involved in this. Yeah, there's a lot. You can write your congressman. You can write your senator. You can have rallies on college campuses. You can adopt prisoners of a conscience. You can write letters to the editor. You can storm this place. Frankly, this Capitol ought to be stormed by people that care about it. You can literally do what Martin Luther King did. Ultimately, maybe some people are going to have to be so, they're going to have to kind of be willing to kind of force this administration, this Congress to do. There's a lot that can be done. And the young people, I think they're looking for the authenticity. If you can take the same effort that Gary Hogan done in sexual trafficking and transfer that to this issue, you can do a tremendous amount. But the question is, who's going to take the leadership? That's the challenge. Be like Martin Luther King. Be like Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's proof. We've seen it in history. If there's enough people who speak out about something, then things do get done. Things happen. So that's a beautiful thing about American government. But actually getting the motivation to make something like that happen is the problem, I suppose. So what is you're both part of this organization, an initiative called the 21st Century Wilberforce Initiative. What is it doing to try and motivate this kind of change?
Well, one of the first initiatives that we began working on, so we came back from Iraq, we issued this report. Of course, there's an educational component, just making people aware of what's happening. You know, the news media has done a decent job of covering it, but it kind of flares up usually when things are kind of most grievous and then tends to go back below the radar and people aren't cognizant of the fact that thousands of people for the better part of the last 8 months are living in pretty deplorable circumstances with no real hope for the future. So just kind of keeping that at the forefront on people's radar screens. We've been working with a number of other like-minded non-governmental organizations to spearhead a letter within the NGO community, but then also in partnership with Hill offices that urges the administration to fill this special envoy post that Mr. Wolf referenced. You know, we're under no illusions that a special envoy alone is going to fix the problem, but obviously having a senior person at the State Department that's charged specifically with focusing on these issues, coming up with policy solutions. Now it's far more than just a religious freedom issue. I mean, you have a humanitarian component. There's a refugee component. I mean, looking at all of those issues with the lens of wanting to maintain a, you know, vibrant pluralistic society within the Middle East that includes Christians and other religious minorities. So for your listeners, I'm not sure exactly when this will air, but there's a congressional letter in the works that's being spearheaded by Congresswoman Anna Eshoo and Congressman Forbes on the House side and Senator Blunt and Senator Stabenow on the Senate side. They can contact their representatives, urge them to sign on to this letter. It's a bipartisan issue. You know, it simply presses and urges the administration to follow through on what the president did when he signed the legislation and simply appoint someone capable to fill that position and start coming up with really comprehensive policy solutions.
And lastly, I think this ought to be one of the major issues in the 2016 election. I think every person running for office, House, Senate, President, both parties, and I think this has always been a bipartisan issue too. You used to have, you know, President Reagan, but you also had Scoop Jackson, a Democratic senator from Washington State. You had Tom Lantos, a Democratic member from California, and Henry Hyde, a Republican. So it's always been a bipartisan. But I think people ought to, you know, one, they ought to be asking their people running. There ought to be debates centered around this, presidential debates. Every person running ought to get a questionnaire where they ask, do they understand what it's about? But I would like to see this become one of the major issues in the 2016 election.
And to follow on briefly, if you visit our website, the 21st Century Wilberforce Initiative website, there's material there that's more, it's kind of a condensed version of the report that's more appropriate for a faith-based audience, whether you're in a Bible study or a church, that it's kind of a four-page summary of our findings, but also the biblical significance of these lands and, you know, the scripture references that will help really put kind of meat on the bones, that this isn't just a place that exists kind of in antiquity, that there is a vibrant Christian community there that was not a Western import. In fact, it's the cradle of Christianity, that they still speak Aramaic, the language of Jesus, and really just kind of helping to internalize and connect with the church, the suffering church in Iraq.
Thanks to both of you for your time today and also for the work that you're doing on this important issue. I just encourage our listeners to take one of the ways that you can get involved that we just heard about and maybe get involved in that way. This is a tragic issue and something that I think we all, especially as Christians, should care about deeply. So thanks to both of you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next time.